the times of Israel. They're talking about how Yemenis were capable of somehow shutting down the Eilat port in Israel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems that next week they're going to shut down the port, that it's so much important because the only Red Sea port for Israel. And looking at the way that somehow Yemen, nobody's talking about Yemen. And because we have a lot to talk about.
they can't fix it. I mean, there's, you know, the United States and Israel have found out that they're impotent to subject the Yemenis, particularly the Houthis, to bring them under their heel. I mean, this is really a remarkable story. And the people of Yemen are doing something historic. They have stood up and gone toe-to-toe militarily with what some would argue is at least the strongest naval and aviation power in the world. I wouldn't necessarily say that the U.S. is the strongest military power, but in terms of naval force, it's at the top. And in terms of the multitude of aircraft. And we failed, despite, you know, Trump's claim, oh, they capitulated. Well, please. And, you know, Israel's gone in and bombed them. And they keep lobbing missiles back into Ben Gurion Airport and other places. Yeah, you know, I think if the Houthis really got serious or could get some additional assistance from outside, they could really put a hurt on Israel. But here, look, they forced Israel to shut a port because nobody is using it, because they couldn't get there because they get blown out of the water if they dared to get in the Red Sea. Oh, just an amazing story, really, and a credit to the people of Yemen.
Larry, the attitude of Yemenis is somehow amazing because they're somehow capable of absorb all of these difficulties and the hit back. And, you know, the patience, this sort of this ability that I've just mentioned is somehow making them so much difficult to deal with. I think one of the main difficulties that the United States had during the conflict, 7 days, 10 days that the United States went to the Red Sea to go against them. This was the main issue, wasn't it?
You, what do you mean this is the main issue? I'm not sure I follow.
Because they were witnessing that Yemen doesn't care about the way that they're hitting them, because they're going to respond without.
Well,
they don't show the pain that they're feeling.
Okay. Yeah, they don't let the pain and suffering force them to surrender. Because I'm sure they weep. You know, they definitely weep for the loss of life of their, you know, fellow citizens. And but they don't curl up into a fetal position and say, oh my God, we got to surrender. We can't endure this. They've really demonstrated a level of courage and tenacity that is, it's sort of reminiscent of, to bring up ancient history of the 300 Spartans that stood against the hordes of Persians or Babylonians coming in. They, on paper, there was no way they could have done this. They're just good. They're small. They're economically, weak, but, there's something to be said for the courage of these people and what they have demonstrated. You know, they have, and it's not for a selfish cause. They sit there and say, look, the Zionists are murdering these Palestinians and women and children every day, day after day. Somebody's got to do something. And they stood up to do something. Meanwhile, well, actually, I guess there is some good news that's coming out of Bogota, Colombia, that a group of 12 nations, including China, have met there to, they're going to start as a whole imposing sanctions on Israel now to try to force Israel into a ceasefire and to you know, stop the killing and allow humanitarian aid in. I hope that is, I hope they follow through on it. So if they do that, then the Houthis in Yemen, they're no longer alone. But it is, you know, it's a credit to the Houthis that their particular religious faith, you know, there's some people that talk it and some people that live it. And they're living it and willing to say, you know, if we die, we die, but we die serving God.
It seems that the United States is trying to negotiate, is trying to somehow send signals to Iran that they want to negotiate with Iranians, the United States. We've learned from Ali Larijani, one of the important figures in Iran, who's so close to the supreme leader of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on in that front between the United States and Iran?
Well, the Iranian negotiating position, I think, became clearer yesterday. There was a representative of the foreign ministry that spoke to Press TV. And one of my contacts at Press TV forwarded that to me. And, you know, Iran said, okay, if we're going to talk, let's get some things straight. Number one, if we're going to be open to inspection and international oversight, then Israel has to as well. And because we're not going to get into an agreement where you inspect us, but nobody inspects Israel. No. Israel's got to be subjected to the same requirements that you're levying on us. Very fair. Absolutely. In my view. They said, then, you know, Israel's got to pay for the damage they've done to us. Because they struck us, you know, we didn't strike them. They struck us. And then we're going to need ironclad guarantees from the United States that if you're going to enter into a negotiation process, then you're not going to authorize any kinds of attacks on us. And, you know, if you can't agree to those conditions, then, you know, we're going to be at war was essentially the message. And, but, you know, that's, you know, I published that last night at sonar21.com. That means that I think going forward, Iran's going to prepare for the next round of being attacked. I do not see, you know, Iran's not going to launch any preemptive strike on anyone. They're going to hold back. They will respond, though, if attacked, and they will respond with even greater force than they did the last time. And as now they don't have to worry about bombing the port at Eilat because it's closed down, you know. So it's, I think Iran realized it got played for a fool. It trusted the United States that they were involved in a legitimate diplomatic process. And instead of honoring the negotiations, the United States used that as a subterfuge to try to decapitate Iran's leadership and destroy the country.
It seems that Iran is getting so much close to China and Russia in terms of air defense systems. Larry, your opinion on the air defense system, do we have any information on the Chinese air defense system?
Because I don't. You know, they keep talking that Iran is getting the Chinese air defense system. I think the only recent case where we've actually seen it operate against in a combat environment was in Pakistan. And I'm not sure how effective it was. Apparently, you know, it shot down some French-made jets. I guess India was flying French-made jets that and the Pakistanis have Chinese. The only country where you've got a proven air defense system that works to take down both ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones is Russia. I don't know what the Iranians are thinking. I know what, if I was in the decision-making position, I'd be going with Russia, not China. Because Chinese equipment, as far as I'm concerned, is just not battle-tested. You know, it may look good on paper, but can it actually perform the job? Whereas the Russian system is taking, you know, they're fending off multiple drone attacks, and they defeated the ATACMS missile, the Storm Shadow missile. So, you know, they've proven that the Russian equipment can get the job done.
The priority, Larry, in your opinion, is the for Iranian air defense system is to hit the fighter jets or to hit the missiles coming from fighter jets?
Yes. How about all of the above? All of the above.
Which one is more easier for Iran to do, in your opinion?
Oh, shoot down the jets, the fixed-wing aircraft. Hitting the cruise missiles can be a more challenging target, but you know, it's smaller. But that's what you've got. You correctly note that systems like the Patriot, those are designed to hit aircraft, not ballistic missiles. And as was proven, has been proven over and over again in both Ukraine and in Israel, they suck. The Patriot sucks at dealing with missiles and even having trouble with the Garand drone. But, you know, that's where Russia has a clear advantage in having not just the S-300, S-400, S-500, they've got the Pantsir system. So they have a layered air defense system that can deal with a variety of threats. That's ultimately what Iran needs.
Here is, Larry, what Maria Zakharova yesterday said, that Moscow considers itself entitled to use weapons against military targets of countries that allow Kiev to strike deep into Russia with their weapons. It seems that what is the recent advancements, the recent changes that has happened in the region that there's so much concern about Russia getting hit by these missiles, I don't know, that coming from the United States or maybe Germany or United Kingdom?
Well, there's been the talk, and I want to emphasize talk as opposed to action, about sending long-range missiles. When the word came out, you know, I guess last week, that the United States was considering giving Tomahawk cruise missiles to Kiev, that was a red line right there. Because the problem with the Tomahawk is it can be equipped with a nuclear warhead. Well, when it's fired, it doesn't turn a particular, you know, if it's carrying a nuclear warhead, it turns red. If it's carrying conventional, it turns green. No, there's no way to know what's on it. So as a Russian military planner, you have to assume they're shooting a nuke at us. Zakharova's warning, call it a subtle warning to the West, is that if the Germans decide to provide a Taurus missile, then targets in Germany will be hit by Russia. And they can do it very easily with your Reshnik missile. The same is for any other country, but here's the problem these countries have. They're neither France nor England nor Germany are sitting on major stockpiles of long-range missiles that you could funnel in there to try to change the strategic picture. And in fact, the Germans, despite what Merz says, all the other Germans are like, oh, wait a minute, they're cowboy. We're not going to go do that. We're not going to, you know, widen this war. France is facing, you know, a real economic crisis. So, you know, the last thing it needs is to, you know, deepen that crisis by getting into a shooting war with Russia. So, but the Russians are reacting to what the West has been saying. And they're making it, you know, they're publicly reacting just to say, hey, you can't keep threatening us like this and think that we're not going to respond, because we will. You're notified. You're on notice.
So So what's the point here to attack Joe Biden over and over when you're the president of the United States? You're in charge.
Well, my first reaction would be, why have you not fulfilled your promise to your MAGA horde? You aren't out of the war. It's your war now. So why are you doing this? But I know why he's doing it. Nima, in the last 72 hours, 96 hours, MAGA has begun to sunder. It's begun to split right down its heart. Part of this is one of Trump's confidants and good friends, and I talk to him every day guy, Tucker Carlson, has devastated him. First, with the expose on the Epstein affair. Second, with his more or less takedown of Senator Cruz. Third, with his open-air celebration, almost, of the fact that MAGA is splintering, and then his interview with the president of Iran. He has caused Trump's base, his fundamental base, to split. And one of the issues they're splitting over, of course, increasingly, it's been that way slowly but surely over Gaza. But it's now really that way over Ukraine and over his failure to deliver his promises. Even Marjorie Taylor Greene, I almost fell off my seat this morning when I watched the video of her talking about these issues and talking about Donald Trump and about what he has not done that he promised he would do in very strident terms. He's losing people. Other than morons and imbeciles like Lindsey Graham, he's losing people. He's losing his base, and he's only a few months into the first year of his second administration. So that's the first reason. He is searching desperately for words, for statements, for actions that will restore at least a modicum of the solid nature of his base. That's the first thing. The second thing, I think, is along with this, we are in a very different situation right now. And I am not at all sure that Trump understands this, nor, more importantly, am I sure, I know his cabinet doesn't, none of the principals do, but I'm not sure the billionaires behind him understand this other than in a very negative way. And I'll take a few minutes and just explain what I mean by that. First of all, we are in World War III. We are already engaged in World War III. I recommended to some people this morning to pick up a copy of A Treatise, which is absolutely beautiful in its prose and the turn of the century, 19th to 20th century way John Maynard Keynes writes. It's just beautiful to read him, but it's not beautiful to contemplate what he's saying. The book is a small pamphlet published after the Versailles Treaty was molded, such as it was, and it's called The Economic Consequences of the Peace. Now, John Maynard Keynes was the principal economic guru there at the conference with responsibility for reporting on it and dealing with the economic dimensions of the peace. If you look at that, and you look at, and of course, JMK had no idea that he was predicting the future, but if you look at what he describes in there as the reasons for why Britain and France wanted 1914 to happen, wanted the war to happen, bred the war in many respects, it was because Germany was becoming not only the dominant economic, technocratic, you name it, power, it was overwhelming both France and Britain in terms of their population, and in terms of the imperial reach that especially Britain, but France also enjoyed at that time. In other words, as he points out in the Treatise, both countries, France and Britain, wanted to restore their empires as swiftly as possible, buttress them, shore them up. Germany was the biggest threat, and they figured war was the best solution. So forget the Archduke Ferdinand and all the rest, the automaticity of the mobilization tables and such. Both wanted war. Then he goes into the economic consequences of the peace. And he demonstrates conclusively that it didn't work. It didn't work. In fact, it probably set both empires back, especially economically. They owed the United States their lives. They owed everything they owned to the United States as the main banker of their efforts. So 20 years later, and they designed the piece to do this, and this is the man to tell you that, they designed the piece to do this. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is defined, I think, very, very well as the most incompetent person who ever entered the room. He simply lost to Lloyd George and Clemenceau, basically. So they built the second war, and they took their countries into the second war in order to restore their empires. Winston Churchill, most formidably of all, and they destroyed those empires. France and Britain destroyed their empires. Now they're clinging to the skirts of America. Well, my point here is that's precisely what we're doing right now with China replacing Germany vis-a-vis us and us replacing Britain and France vis-a-vis those two. And we're in World War III. The battles, the initial skirmishes and battles, they aren't skirmishes in Ukraine. They're pretty serious. And in Southwest Asia, they're pretty serious, are being fought right now. Along the central line, there are clandestine operations going on in the Baltic and the Arctic. There are fomentings of war in Southwest Asia. Don't think for a moment that we're through with that. Bibi will take us into war with Iran. Ultimately, we're going to war with Iran. If you listen to Tucker's interview with the president of Iran this morning, or I listened to it this morning, I think it was done a day or two ago, you just feel for the Iranian president because he still doesn't get it. I mean, if we take him at face value now, he could be dissembling now. I would be if I were he. But if he's really speaking what he thinks and what the Ayatollah thinks and has blessed him to say, he's still fooled. He's still thinks he can work with the United States. If I were he right now, I'd build a nuclear weapon so fast it would make Kim Jong-un's head spin. I'd build a nuclear weapon and I'd say, there, fait accompli, go away, Israel. That's where we're headed. We're headed to another battle in this arc of crisis I've described before, but we're in World War III. This is World War III. Trump hasn't a clue. He hasn't a clue, nor does anyone in his cabinet, except to pursue this war as far as is necessary to restore the American empire. And that's a very dangerous situation because why? It isn't like 1914. It isn't like 1939. We have nuclear weapons.
Terry, what does Europe want from the United States? They're asking for more weapons, but can they get it?
They can get weapons, but they can't get what they need, and they can't get weapons that they're talking about, like PAC-3 Patriots and so forth, in anywhere near the quantities that they would need. And I'm not sure they would do any good anyway, Nima, except to afford more target material for Russians. It's not going to do them any good. And what we're doing is bleeding not only our stocks down to where it's probably incomprehensible what we're doing to ourselves, but we're also bleeding Europe's stocks down. We're now talking about using the intelligence agencies to shift MI6, CIA, and Mossad, principally, to shift weapons around within the European tapestry. And that's absurd. I know people like Mark Rutte, who have the brain of a warthog, are okay with it. But Rutte's showing me that he's worse than Stoltenberg. He has no comprehension of what he's doing, no comprehension of where he's leading the alliance and where ultimately it's going to wind up. Because we're talking about, as I said, engaging in World War III, and they're going to lose. But everyone's going to lose because when the American empire realizes it's losing badly, catastrophically, it will use nuclear weapons.
Why does Germany want long-term missiles, long-range missiles? Is that they're talking about 2,000 kilometers the range of these missiles, and how is that going to, are they going to use it against Russia, and what would be the reaction from Russia? Does Donald Trump and his administration thinking of these things that are happening? Because after all, you can say that Germany is buying these things, but if they were being used against Russia, if they use it against Russia, what would be the reaction? What is the outcome? How can not, how can the administration not understand the consequences of what they're doing right now?
Because Trump is an idiot. I mean, that's a simple answer. But I think we're looking at a situation here where the coincidence of timing might not be completely opportune, but I think Merz is, as I've said before, very short numbered in his days as chancellor. I think he's already lost the support of the majority of the German people. And once they understand, viscerally understand what he's doing, it'll be like Pershing II deployments by Ronald Reagan in his administration, when we disturbed Europe so badly, we almost lost it. We almost sundered NATO with that. The INF Treaty, of course, was a result of that, when we decided that was enough. We'd go ahead and do with the Russians, the Soviets at the time, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty. That's what brought that about, really. But the brouhaha in Europe over deployment of Pershing IIs was not unlike the brouhaha is going to be over this, if especially if one of them is used and Germany's trademark is on it. Merz is gone. Overnight, he'll be gone. So we're looking at a political situation that could give us a partial solution in terms of Germany. But even if it doesn't, Nima, this isn't going to change anything except make Putin more ruthless in his prosecution of the special military operation. And it's ruthless enough right now. I mean, he was taking a city a week. He's taking a city a day, or two or three cities a day now. And Ukraine is virtually folding under the juggernaut. All he's got to do is keep that up. And one wonders now if he's not going to be incentivized to keep it up a lot further than he originally intended, to include taking Odessa. I would say right now it's 50-50. He's probably going to take Odessa, and he's not going to give it back. Not any more than he's going to give the eastern provinces back, or give Crimea back, or anything like that. So we're looking at simply perpetuating the conflict in order to, in effect, give Putin more territory and more of Ukraine. Ukraine truly will be a rump state, if it's anything at all, after this is over. And Donald Trump, at the end of the 50 days, will manufacture some new sort of thing. The 50-day mandate is meaningless. It's meaningless coming from Trump. That's what bothered me about the Iranian president this morning, his naivete, if that's the right word, and if his words were blessed by Ayatollah and therefore mean a fairly comprehensive acceptance of those words, that they're even willing to talk to the United States anymore. It's mind-boggling that they would be at this point, especially knowing that Netanyahu is still there. I just watched a videotape of Katz, the defense minister, and several other generals around him as they surveyed the humanitarian operation in Gaza. What were they surveying? This morning, the UN said 675 people were killed in the last couple of days around these humanitarian food dissemination points. That's what they are. They're killing grounds. And that's what they, every day, Haaretz says, well, 75 people died today at the food place. 100 died today. 35 died today. That's all they're doing, is murdering people, continuing the murder of Palestinians while they're trying to get food and water. It's the most unconscionable thing you could possibly conceive of. And here's the Minister of Defense chortling in the video. Laughing in the video with his generals as he watches this destruction take place. And we're party to that. We're party to that. We're blessing it. We're working with it. We're going to apparently now bless whatever it is Netanyahu wants to do, to move these people somewhere else, wherever that somewhere else is, or to create a beautiful city in Gaza for them to live in, temporarily, of course, a concentration camp by any other name. And meanwhile, in the West Bank, it's getting worse and worse. In Syria, they just attacked again in order to defend the Druze. In Lebanon, they have said the ceasefire, it doesn't exist. They've told the Lebanese government they're not leaving. This is unconscionable what we are blessing, but it is, as I said, it's a theater in World War III. It's just remains to be seen whether we're going to reopen the war with Iran and when we're going to do it. And are we going to do it on our own initiative, or are we going to let Netanyahu start it and act like we've just been drugged into it? I predict that's what Trump will do because he's a chicken shit, basically.
There you mentioned the interview of the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian. He was criticized that the people, I don't know if how much the Iranian media, you read the Iranian media, you're aware of what's going on, you know, but he was just, they smashed him after the interview. Because they thought that he humiliated the Iranian position. He humiliated the Iranian side because he wanted to. I don't know, and I don't see any other government in Iran coming and being willing to talk with the United States other than this government.
When I was listening to it, I think I had the same feeling some Iranians might have had. And I was thinking to myself, are they setting him up? Is the Ayatollah and others on what we call the hardliners, are they setting him up? Or have they written his remarks so that they can get rid of him? Because that's how crazy I thought his remarks were. Almost insane when you think about what's happened to Iran. Almost like he was cowed. And he was talking as a man who was cowed, a president who was cowed. And why would you be cowed by a Yamamoto-type attack on you? That, you know, I was reading some of the Iranian press, and they were talking about how these people had been assassinated. They were more or less on leave, as it were. You know, they were taking a little time off because the situation had relaxed a bit. They were with their families. They were with their children. And they were assassinated. Typical Israeli actions, but that's not what makes a president get up and give a talk like that, give an interview like that. So I take the Iranian people at face value, what you're telling me about their feelings. I'd be that way too.
They don't, you cannot attack a country and you somehow feel that they're going to overthrow the government because of your attack. It's unbelievable,
it's
Larry,
bumbling.
What has happened, how they...
It's bumbling stupidity. I mean, it's just, it goes right back to my own war, the one I know most about, the Vietnam, where we thought bombing Ho Chi Minh would make him submit. It just made him adamantine. It made him absolutely unrelenting. And it made his generals and his colonels and his soldiers in the field the same way. I know my tour in Vietnam was fighting Red Star wearing hardcore North Vietnamese Army regiments. They were absolutely committed to the conflict. In fact, Tet had taken out their most probable opponent should they be victorious in the South, the Viet Cong. Tet had pretty much eliminated the Tet Offensive, and our response to it had pretty much eliminated the Viet Cong. I could not find a Viet Cong to fight. I found hardcore khaki-clad NVA Red Star-wearing Ho Chi Minh soldiers to fight. That's what the bombing did. That's what our counteroffensive against the Viet Cong did. You are not going to convince, you got it right. You're not going to convince any people to cease supporting their government by bombing the bejesus out of the people. No way.